Welcome to the Tesla Motors Club podcast. My name is Lewis.
And I'm Mike.
Today, we have a fantastic show planned for you. We have a very special guest, Wes, yes. Who's a former program manager that worked at Tesla in the early days with the Autopilot team. So that's exciting. Lots to dig in there. We'll also discuss a new price increase on FSD. There's been some rumors around the Model 3 and Model Y losing their stocks. So some drama on that. There's also, speaking of drama, there's some drama around Moody's credit rating for Tesla. So we'll see what's going on with that. And a lot more. Episode number 20 starts now. Welcome, welcome. Hey, Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, aside from the 103 degree temps here in California.
Oh, man.
It's a little toasty.
That sounds pleasant for someone in southern in Texas, but you know, we've had it nice and cool. It's in the 90s here, so it's nice.
Yeah, this is not my idea of fun.
I bet. So, all right. So I have to say, let's dive in. We got a lot to talk about.
We do.
And, you know, Wes, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Yay. Thank you. Great to be here.
Awesome. Awesome to have you. So first, I just want to say, can you maybe just give a brief introduction for our audience who has not had the pleasure of speaking to you as we have?
Yeah, no worries. So my Tesla experience is program manager for Autopilot. 2014, 2015 timeframe. And before that was at Dell for about 10 years doing project program management, lots of laptops, lots of desktops, fun stuff. And then transitioned to Microsoft, did Windows 7, and then spent about 6 years on Xbox related stuff, worked on the kernel of the 360, did Blu-ray software, did a bunch of other stuff with game streaming. And Tesla was in my future, and got in on what was the most amazing ride while I was there, and that was brilliant. Got very homesick for the Northwest, so came back here and was on Google Cloud TPUs after that, and spent about four and a half years there, and now retired. So that's me in a nutshell.
That's awesome. That's a lot of really awesome projects. I could probably talk to you about all of those things that are not Tesla that would get my nerd my nerd interest going. But so first, I guess before we dive too much into it, can you just give a brief just explanation? I work with many program managers throughout my career. Can you just explain what a program manager is so those that don't know can get a rough idea?
Has anybody ever brought you coffee? That's a program manager. program managers run the gambit. So there's some program managers that are just like totally hands off. They're like, yeah, I'm just going to do presentations and maybe come up with the vision, you know, and this is what the product should do. This is the minimum viable product. You know, this is how much profit we're going to make. And, you know, like, kind of maybe basic stuff. And then there's other product managers on the other end of the spectrum who are deep, deep down into the weeds, technical, really like to know how all the code works and like, hey, why are you architecting like that? And then also on the other side, you know, when you're making software, it has to run on hardware. So there's some product managers or program managers, I've been called both, I've been called lots of things, that can go deep on the hardware too and be like, so I see that you're coding it like that and that's great. And that sounds like a good code base to run in, but like, why are you using this hardware? Or, you know, why have you programmed your chip like that? And that's kind of me. Like I like the hardware. I like the software. I like services. You know, I ran Xbox Live with an amazing team while I was there, like shout out to those people because they know who they are. And that was brilliant. So like, I love the whole stack. You know, computers and me have go back a long way.
Sweet.
So anyway, that's program management in a nutshell. Like you can be one end of the spectrum, pretty hands off and just kind of like dealing with presentations and hand wavy things. And then there's, you know, the other side where you can be very hands on. And that's what I liked. But I am always ready to bring somebody a coffee or a whiskey, depending on how blocked.
I'm definitely on the whiskey side. I've been caffeine free for a few years, so
there you go.
Whiskey, yeah. can't turn that down.
Some of our best code, man, were whiskey days at Microsoft.
Yeah, and probably some of the worst code. No, I'm just
there is a cliff. That's for sure.
The Balmer Peak. If you want to Google the Balmer Peak, there's a great.
That's what I'm talking about. Totally, yeah. It's real. It totally is.
All right. So Tesla Autopilot, right? That was your time there was mostly around the Autopilot team. Can you maybe give us a little bit about the early days on the team, what it was like?
Yeah, totally. So, and remember when I went into interview, like I hadn't done really any AI per se, except for skeletal tracking on the Kinect hardware. And if people look up my LinkedIn profile, they'll be able to see that. But yeah, like, and I'm interviewed by this crazy, amazing engineer. And at the end of the day, like, you know, I could be saying like lots of names, but I haven't checked with any of these people, so I won't. But these people sure. know who they are if they hear this. But yeah, like, I got interviewed, and you know, this engineer is like, well, this is how the AP system, we think it's going to work. And this is where we want to put the sensors. And this is what we want to do this. I'm like, why would you do that? Like, why would you put them there? Like, wouldn't it be better if it was like this? And he's like, actually, we've been talking about that. And I was like, well, great. Like, that sounds awesome.
Excellent.
And then he walks out of the room, and then other people walk in, and I had to write this big, long letter to Elon about the engineering stuff that I've done in the past and things I'm proud of. And anyway, that's a long story, but it started off that when I got hired on, I had the choice of one of four roles, and AP was one of them, and that's the one that I chose. There was only 11 people on the team at that time. Everybody was just absolutely amazing, all of these people that were on the team at that point. And when I left, we were 52. Wow. Had done a crazy amount of hiring, all people top of their field, lots of people from Carnegie Mellon. You know, they had an amazing robotics lab, and the managers that were there at the time, the controls manager and the safety manager, all of those people were hired while I was there, and just absolutely an amazing path to get to releasing traffic aware cruise control, which was one of the first things that, you know, was a comfort feature that we released. And then all of the safety stuff that we did with AEB and, you know, side collision warning, was just absolutely phenomenal, you know, to be able to pump out that code in that short amount of time and, you know, basically make the cars not hit things and hit other cars on the road anymore was an amazing achievement.
So in those days, I guess, obviously this is back before, you know, way before Dojo, way before Tesla was making their own chips. Yep. So they had like Mobileye and some of that stuff going on. Yeah. So were your team mostly focused on the software, or were you also kind of digging a lot into the hardware back then as well?
No, we made all the hardware. So we bought the little micro, you know, a little chip that basically would take lots of the data from the Mobileye chip. And it came across as, I'm not going to get all technical and detailed into it, but basically we would take the outputs of that chip and we would still have to interpret them to turn that into something that we could control the vehicle, you know, kind of lat and long, and make the car do what it should. We worked very closely with Mobileye. We also were developing hardware too at the time. So working very closely with NVIDIA and trying to get them to understand automotive, how to make an automotive chip. So yeah, we did lots of that development while I was still there.
Sweet. That's really cool. So, and I guess, a general question I have is, like, obviously there's a lot of drama over, you know, FSD will be out in 2 years and blah 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 that. Totally. And you know, there we'll dig more into that, I think. But how do you feel the team felt back then when you're there? Do you think the majority of them felt that you were that close, or was it more of a, yeah, marketing, or, you know, the you know, Elon's optimistic, but they are still questioning or unsure of if they would be able to hit those targets. Do you think the team felt they were realistic?
Yeah, I kind of felt that surface streets or city streets, that code was, you know, in its very new state, mm-hmm. And trying to handle all of the crazy nuances of city streets versus the highway is a much bigger and formerly completely intractable problem for code.
Sure.
And you need neural networks to be able to solve that. And mm-hmm. neural networks hadn't really, you know, evolved that much by that time. And sure. Obviously, as we can see now, like, neural networks have evolved amazingly fast, but mm-hmm. still, like, it's still a very difficult problem to bring in all of these aspects of the road to make the car actually be a fully autonomous car. So yeah, at the end of the day, like, we felt like this was completely achievable. Mm-hmm. How close we were is, you know, for people that are in software and tech, like, you can feel like you're 90% of the way there and it took you X amount of time, but that last 10% is really, really hard to get to.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And the first 80% is fine, but the second 80% is a real pain in the ass.
Yeah. Yeah. Trying to get that last percent. And I've written this on the forum, that it really looks like with some of the advances of 10.69, granted, I haven't driven it yet, but it really feels like with the, let's call it the lane wall, mm-hmm. That network that's creating that wall is brilliant. I love it. It's like explainability in AI. Like, you can mm-hmm. see what it's doing. You can see it move. Like, it's brilliant. And then to have the median safe area, that's brilliant too. And I wrote this on the forum that I think that we're getting to the point where prior to this, we were kind of just at 1.9. And now it feels like we're bordering on potentially 2.9s. And to make an FSD car and, like, release it, you need to be at like 6 or 7 9s.
Right.
In other words, to explain for folks who maybe don't know what I'm talking about.
Non-statistics nerds.
Yeah, is that the car has to be able to travel, like, you know, a billion miles before it kind of has an incident. You know, to be kind of this, Elon talks about it being 10, 100,000 times safer than a human. That's what you kind of need, because cars in general right now, when humans are behind the wheel, they tend to hit things a lot. And by a lot, you know, the car only, I can't remember exactly the figure, but it's, you know, a billion miles will be a remarkable improvement from what it is today. And that will be something that is extremely valuable in the marketplace.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think,
do you feel like I answered your question? Sorry if I rattled.
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure. There are no right or wrong answers.
Excellent. So. I have many answers then.
So, okay. So obviously, you know, the team felt it was achievable. So back then, were you made it sound like, so were they not really using neural nets early on when you were there, or were they just starting to use neural nets?
Was it just very new, because like AlexNet, you know, and a lot of the mm-hmm. new kind of amazing stuff was very mm-hmm. nascent. It was very novel, but it is so new.
Sure.
Like, you know, you're just kind of reading these white papers, you know, and your eyes are just popping out of your head. You're like, what are they able to do? My God, they're able to see a cat with just this amount of code. Like, how is that even possible? You know, and people are flipping out, you know, now we take sure. it for granted. You know, if I say the hot word, my phone will, you know, immediately understand completely what I'm talking about. But you know, that is very nascent back then. And the ability to see lanes was very hard. Mobileye had spent a lot of time, crazy amount of training effort, burning that algorithm into the Mobileye chip, you know, the ASIC, the custom ASIC mm-hmm. at that time. And now, you know, we're able to train a neural network in a matter of hours that mm-hmm. can do the same thing. Like, it's pretty amazing. And it's much, much less a hardware problem at this point. It's much more of a software problem. And by software, I mean, it's a neural net problem, and a neural net is very complex in its nature. So it's so much work that still needs to be going into that, that still needs to be going into the tools and training networks to be able to get that to be reality. But it's progressing.
Figuring out how to layer them together is another interesting problem.
It's so complex. Yeah. And, shout out to James Delma, who does an amazing job at explaining this stuff. He's fascinating to watch, and I watch it all the time. He and Dave do a really good job of explaining how things work, going over release notes, like Dr. Know-It-All does it good too. James is really great. It's great for the community to be able to have that knowledge be spread around.
So actually, I got a question regarding neural nets for you. For the listeners in our audience, what's the relationship of the neural net that we use today versus the hardware stack we have today? You know, I think most people kind of view hardware as this mythical thing that we always have to increase CPU. Oh, okay. And you're talking about the sophistication of the neural net, but I don't hear the hardware being addressed. Could you marry that together for our listeners?
Let me give you a little answer and then tell me if I'm getting down where you're trying to get to.
All right.
In the car, you have an inference chip, and that chip just processes the trained model. So the trained model is tiny compared to the thing that you started with.
Sure.
Prior, the model and when it's training requires all these crazy amount of chips, all this compute power. And it's taking a crazy amount of training data and training this model layer by layer in a neural network or potentially several neural networks. That those neural networks may come together to form a bigger one or maybe even different ones then. And that's all Tesla's secret sauce. Like, that is very hard or potentially impossible to know. I mean, Green the Only on Twitter seemingly is looking sometimes at that code, and I think James is too, to an extent, but it's not like freeware, you know, or it's not like on GitHub so anybody can go look at it. And back in the day, I believe they were using Inception V3 as their model. But anyway, the point is that when it's trained for the car, it's just running inference, and the car is perfectly capable. The chip, it has so many flops, so much compute power that it's perfectly capable of running these models at very low latency so that it can control the car. So there's that. That's the hardware kind of car side. But then on the training side and how many models are running and how many models are being trained, that's largely unknown. And I don't care to know all of those details. I am much more happy to be a consumer of the code now. But from a hardware standpoint, this is why the latest hot chips talk was so fascinating. And I believe it was Ganesh. I don't know him because I wasn't at the company when he was there. But the work that he's done from AMD and the work that he's doing at Tesla is fascinating. And this, I think it's like fab out wafer that he was talking about is fascinating because the yields are very difficult at a large wafer size. So if that's the path that they've gone down, like, good for them. Like, Cerebras is another company that's tried that, and it's very difficult because yields and chips are hard. It's really hard.
They actually explained, so they're not expecting to make like a single device the size of a wafer like Cerebras or some of the others have done. Yeah. They're actually very modular, so they'll produce a ton of chips on a wafer, but they can have certain ones be bad, and that's fine. And they look for, I think it was like 5x5 segments or something that are good, and that's how they're actually doing it. But it is very innovative. And again, if you didn't listen to last week's podcast, we did cover some of that there. But if that's anyone has questions, by all means. I used to work in semiconductor manufacturing, so I've made AMD chips and worked.
Oh, excellent!
You've been in TSMC fabs and all that kind of stuff. So
awesome.
But yeah, it is a really interesting subject. So I think, Mike, the one area of your question that, you know, we haven't technically addressed it. I agree. Everything Wes said is correct. And I agree with right now, the chips that we have in our cars are not being fully utilized for the inference of the neural nets. And all the Dojo stuff, again, for the training side. But the one area that is still up for debate, and there's some rumors around it that we'll get into later, is basically the cameras and the data processing of the cameras that's getting fed into the model. That is the piece that maybe
I'm happy to talk about upgrading. That too.
Yep. So,
But yeah, some, and I think Green has talked about this specifically, that they feel like the inference chip is 100% loaded. And I would, and I kind of said this on Twitter, but that's what I would do. I would still fully load that chip because you don't want to waste these cycles. So to control the car, obviously that's primary, that gets executed first. But then when you have spare cycles, I would take those spare cycles and I would, you know, if anybody wants to run, you know, code, shadow code, or any type of code in real time in the car, I would, you know, I would essentially auction those off to engineers who want to try something, you know, in the field.
Sure.
We did that a lot with Xbox too, where we could turn on and off different things in the field, not necessarily A/B testing type things, but, you know, any type of code that we wanted to try out, you know, to see if things could run more efficiently or if we would have, you know, more stable ways of doing things, consuming less cycles, you know, better internet communication, you know, lower bandwidth or more resilient to outages, things like that.
Sure.
But yeah, the inference chip, I don't believe, is anywhere near loaded currently.
Yeah, I mean, it, again, I haven't looked at it that closely. It's definitely on my to-do list to dig into the models, you know, and decompile some things and take a look, because, you know, it's just something that I'm interested in. So I'll be curious to see if they do need to upgrade it. But we do have a quick question from the audience. Michael asked, what's the size of wafers these days? I used to work with 8-inch wafers in the 90s with TI and photolithography. Yeah. Great question. I also worked in photolithography. It's a very interesting question. And he said, as an operator, not as an engineer, tech, or anything like that. I mean, operators are important too. Machine operators, without them, wafers wouldn't get made at the yield rates that you need. Now to answer your question, generally they're 300 millimeters, so almost 12 inches. So that's kind of the industry standard. There was always talk about them getting larger. I'm not sure that they will. There's a lot of complications and changes they'd have to make to the fabs, but I've worked in 200 mil fabs and 300 mil fabs, and I've had to deal with the transition, and it's a whole mess. But anyway, so 300 millimeters, the current. To the point of, you know, the chips being maybe maxed out, it's possible, you know, but I agree with you. I also feel like there's a certain amount of optimization that you do, and then you stop when you don't need to do anymore. There's certainly plenty of room with newer models and as they improve things to where they could optimize and, you know, reduce the amount of, resource utilization being necessary there. Yeah. So can you mentioned you could share more about the cameras and all the getting the data in and all that. So can you give us a little bit about, you know, the cameras, I guess, when you were there and how some of those decisions were made, like the camera locations? I know, for example, you know, there's a lot of contention on why they're where they're at.
Yep.
And things like that.
Yeah. So when I first started at Tesla, one of the first meetings I had with the team with Elon in the room, where we were talking about these camera sensor placements, and the original S had already been kind of packaged for those sensor locations. So the B pillar, you know, and the side repeater and the windshield and all of the sonar pucks, those were all prepackaged into the original design, and they just hadn't been implemented, you know, yet. And that was what my team was tasked with doing. My team was tasked with doing getting all of the hardware in the car, as well as all of the software, and getting that, you know, shipped in a package to customers that they could buy and consume. And originally, the sensors that we had were processing a micro that was pretty small, you know, so we didn't have a lot of compute power, not a lot of memory, not a lot of network. And today's system, at least from what, you know, I had done with my team on two, you know, was much more robust, could handle easily a crazy amount of data from higher, you know, resolution sensors to be able to process that no problem, you know, with lockstep, meaning that there's deterministic connection, you know, when the data always comes through, it's lossless, like, you know, you're not dropping frames or anything. So there's no contention. So you're always getting, you're not starving the micro. And then the micro is never starving, you know, the inference engine, you know, things like that. So there's lots of overhead and safety buffers built into that so that it's all non, you know, it's deterministic, and you're never dropping packets and you're always getting, you know, kind of lockstep two micros being able to agree so that you know that when you control the car, you're doing the right thing. So I, sure. My understanding, you know, from hardware 2 and granted 2.5 and 3 is, you know, out with that card, but all of the wiring and the sensors, you know, I realize that some of the sensors have been upgraded and I don't know exactly why. It could have been for environmental conditions or maybe some other issue that was causing the sensors to degrade. I don't know, but the stuff that we had put in back then was, you know, more than robust enough to be able to control the car, you know, in any environmental condition. That's the whole design.
Sure. And when, and just to be clear, when you say micro, you're talking about microprocessors, like microcontrollers,
yeah, totally.
Basically.
Sorry.
Yeah. I used the same. No, that's fine.
Just, and just any compute, sure any compute that's not the AI inference engine, the neural sure. network, the trained model, because that compute is very, as you probably know, is very different than the inference engine that's running.
Sure. Okay. And so do you personally feel that there's enough cameras on the car or that like the cameras they have today are probably high enough resolution? Do you think that there's any need to increase that? I'm just curious.
Yeah. From what I've seen, they're good. They're good at even high speeds, right? The thing is, and I, you know, mentioning this earlier, is that the software has a way to go, right? Mm-hmm. The hardware can see, right? You really need those front cameras to be able to see wide, mid, and long, and the repeater and the B pillars to be able to see well enough to the side to be able to see high speed incoming traffic. You know, that's really important. And the level of resolution, and it looks like the color space that it's seeing in, mm-hmm. in all environmental conditions is, you know, is able to see at a great enough distance to be able to calculate the amount of time that the car needs to be able to react. And I think we're seeing a lot of this in videos posted online. You know, my kids love to watch the Wham Bam Tesla Cam. And there are a lot of examples out there, you know, I there's a lot of entertainment value to that channel, but there's also some interesting test data that shows up there because you can see the car controlling for these high impact collisions where it's able to modify some amount of that crash energy, you know, before impact sure. occurs. Yep. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, I do feel like the current sensor set and mm-hmm. the current networking and the current micro, you know, the compute memory, it seems extremely adequate. And so that looks to me like what's happening right now. It's the sure. inference engine that keeps changing, right?
Sure.
That's mm-hmm. the thing that keeps changing. And that's something that's not going to be stressing the sensors more, or is going to be stressing the networking or potentially the micro more than likely not. It looks like there's enough pixels to be able to make good control decisions, I guess, is the short.
Okay. So, I mean, I know, so in last week's show, we talked about, we had Doug on and he was talking about some of the innovations from a Vin AI, same parent company to VinFast, you know, making other potentially automated EVs. And they had done things with like fisheye cameras and other types of things. Were there any talks or considerations on like, you know, like why aren't there cameras on the corners? Was it purely just because it was already in the design of the S, as you said, like there wasn't enough justification, like was it deemed that was adequate? So there wasn't enough justification to redesign the car or make changes to the.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There was good coverage. I mean, you can see that. I'm not sure if that's still on Tesla's site, but you know, it was sure. demonstrating on their site the coverage that the car could see in. And there was good redundancy and overlap, you know, in the corners.
Sure.
And so it was able to see good enough. That was sure. The idea.
So, so essentially it can see well enough and you don't need to, so it's not worth redesigning, I guess, all of the things that would need to be redesigned to move cameras around potentially.
Yeah. And I do feel like, you know, it's been a while, so there's probably, and who knows if they're using new sensors. I haven't seen a teardown of what actual sensor they're using, or new mm-hmm. sensors versus old. But, you know, there's always the ability for you to potentially upgrade. But yeah, that would require other changes downstream, and mm-hmm. that, you know, would potentially set the team back, you know, if they had to now potentially have more than one hardware set that they had to design to. So that could make things more complex, and complexity is your enemy. Sure. In trying to make a self-driving car. So I wouldn't see them doing that unless they absolutely had to. They hit some local maxima that caused them sure. to have to rethink that.
So I have to, this transitions and I have to ask, what about radar? So obviously there's a lot of drama around radar. You guys had radar in your original system. Do you agree with that decision? What are your thoughts
totally.
On radar?
I can't even tell you, like, so many of my discussions at that time were with Bosch and trying to get better data out of radar. You know, mm-hmm. it was hard, you know, because they, at that time, I wouldn't say had the best handle on the data that was coming out of their own hardware. And they had people that I had to talk to, and those people had people I had to talk to, and those people had people I had to talk to, and they're all in different time zones. And there's all these different contracts that I have to go through, and multiple NDAs that had to be signed in order to get the kind of data that we needed to be able to do the things that we wanted to do with radar. And then when it came down to it and we had to fuse that data, it was still like, it didn't agree with camera. And fusing it together ended up being more of a crutch, you know, and it's just like, at the end of the day, it's like the camera can see this. It's just like, we have to, you know, with shadows is hard, sun rays is hard, you know, low sun is hard. It's hard for a human. And it's also hard for the neural network to be able to be like, yeah, I'm not exactly sure what I'm seeing here, because I'm kind of blinded, and the sensor can get blinded too. And so you have to be able to control in those situations. So it's like, what are you going to do? And it's, you know, trying to figure that out with software is, I believe, the right decision, you know, to kind of just say, look, radar's great. It has its good uses, but camera can do it, you know, figure it out with the camera. And so I am happy that they've gone down that path, because it just relieves the complexity. And it adds, there is a lot of benefit. I really did like, just to be clear, that, you know, the radar could see through the car in front of you. I did like that. But you know, the camera can do a really good job at kind of judging, you know, cause it sits in a higher position than the driver. So it has a more, you know, higher view. It can see, beyond the car better than the driver can from that point of view. And if you've seen some of these FSD drives that some of these amazing YouTubers do, which, you know, kudos to them, like, amazing work, is that they'll put the camera on top of the car and you can get a much better, you know, vantage point of what that looks like from FSD's point of view. And so I do feel like, you know, the camera can see well, the cameras can see well, and they're, I think they're good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I'm in the same boat. I've spoken about it before, that I definitely, having worked in similar spaces, not for self-driving, but just having different types of sensors giving conflicting info is always a challenge. And obviously it is possible for vision only to do it. So I kind of agree with the simplicity of the stack. I don't think it was a bad choice. I maybe questioned the timing of when they did it, or like in the way in which they did it, but I do kind of wonder, so what are your thoughts on why they dropped the speed limit down, right? Like they took radar out, and then were like, oh, by the way, now you can't autopilot as fast.
They take the highest safety. Sorry, I cut that off.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you're good.
They basically say, hey, like, you know, 90 is hard because there was a lot more weighted fusion on the radar at higher speeds, right? Because the radar can see easily 200 meters, you know, out, and as you go faster, the camera, you know, has less essentially. Those pixels are coming in faster. you know, and radar is less sensitive to that. So I totally get why it was lower. And yeah, and it sucks to get feature limited, you know, during that time, but that was alleviated, thank goodness. And so I'm glad that that's, you know, that's back, you know, so it's at parity again. But I think that's why, you know, it's just,
sure,
it's a safety concern, because it was, that was the scenario that was more, much more heavily weighted on radar.
Sure. So I kind of want to, you know, this topic kind of dovetails into one of the things we were going to talk about. There's been rumors for, I mean, a long time now. I mean, it goes all the way back to last year about Hardware 4. You know, rumor that it may be first coming out on the Cybertruck. We don't know. But basically, it sounds like, you know, this may be upgrading to 5-megapixel cameras. There's also new patents that Tesla's filed for radar a few months ago that maybe it's going to bring back radar. Elon was quoted in saying something along the lines of, he removed radar, you know, for all the various bad reasons, as you just explained, but he is not against bringing it back if there was a higher precision or more accurate or better, more useful radar in the future. And they did have a patent around some of that technology. So, you know, I guess I'm curious of what we think the impact of this would be, or the likelihood of this, you know, coming out in the not too distant future. You think they're going to move to a Hardware 4, or do you think Hardware 3 will last for a while?
Yeah, and when I heard him talk about Hardware 4, I was like, well, that sounds interesting. Maybe it's a die shrink, you know, maybe it's a power efficiency, you know, maybe they do need some more flops, you know, maybe they would do more if they had more. But is it necessary to control the car? I don't think so.
Sure.
Because inference engines, as they keep iterating, they're getting easier to do that compute. So I don't think that, you know, the chip is going to be overloaded, you know, as they keep progressing. I think it should still, you know, be good enough. Hardware 4 does potentially have, you know, the reason why people do new revs of hardware is to get more value out of your silicon. So sure, that's potentially what they're going down that path, right? If each chip costs, you know, 10 or 12 bucks now, maybe they can get that down to a dollar, you know, that's possible, you know, because as things go, and as we've seen, you know, with COVID and the chip industry, the chip industry doesn't like making old memory. They don't like making old nanometer sizes. They really don't. They really like to move their fabs forward because that's higher margin. But the benefit can be, you know, to the company that's buying that too. They can get much better scale, much better efficiency, and end up saving money. And so that's potentially what's, you know, more, I would think, driving Hardware 4 more rather than, you know, larger sensors. I would doubt that. I would think that the sensors will get potentially just better. You know, they might have better color space, or they might, you know, have better pixel depth, you know, something like that, that could potentially make them better. But then again, you know, I wouldn't want to add complexity unless I could demonstrate that I was getting value out of it, you know, that was really good for the vehicle and for the advent of sustainable energy and all that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've personally witnessed that before in previous companies, where like in the era of maybe, you know, like Pentium 4s being out, we had a hardware component that was the equivalent of a 486, this microcontroller.
Yeah.
And we were paying more for that because it was so old and nobody really wanted to make them anymore, that it would have been cheaper to upgrade to something that, you know, is thousands of times more powerful and faster and everything else. So there's certainly some, you know, some possibility of, hey, maybe it's more cost effective to upgrade to some newer stuff. But, you know, there's also, you know, potentially benefit, you know, from going from the 1.2-ish megapixel to the 5-megapixel camera, that maybe they can see better farther away, or, you know, to make some of those decisions and not be as reliant on radar at high speeds or other types of things. Yeah. But I mean, obviously, these are all rumors. We have no idea what we're actually going to see, if anything at all. But you know, thanks for your take on that. That was interesting. So,
yeah, sure.
Mike, do you have any thoughts on this? On, you know, new hardware costs going up. You know, what do you what do you think?
Well, I would be more concerned about backwards compatibility. Tesla's got a huge footprint right now of existing hardware. And with the hardware 4.0, I would be really concerned that it's a new environment. It's not necessarily going to be backwards compatible. And what I've seen vendors do in the past is they build to the new standard. And anything that's on the old standard kind of gets left behind. So I could see a whole generation or two of Teslas getting left behind. You know, they're going to, you know, Elon's going to say, hey, we got the shiny new 4X hardware. We're going to build to it. That's our standard. That's where we're going. So sad. Sorry. Move on. You know, that would be
my fear. There's certainly some truth to that, right? Like we have, so I will say on the whole, Tesla mostly has upgraded people, right? They've, you know, they're folks that have had hardware 2 have gone to 2.5 into 3, and a lot of that has happened.
There have been
some people left behind.
Yeah, they're not going to pull out all the cameras and update the cameras. There's already differences between the old Atom processor and the replacement processor that they brought out. It physically will not
swap. The Ryzen chips.
Yeah. I mean, I can see it going the same way with this, that, you know, Tesla's going to draw a line in the sand and say, to move our technology forward where we want to be, this is it. You go on this side, you go forward, you're on the other side, you stay where you are.
But, yeah, I mean, it's very possible. Obviously, we're speculating here. I don't know what you think about it. In my perspective, I think that Tesla's learned a lot during the process and they're always improving. And I kind of feel like, if we are to move to a hardware 4, which I think is inevitable, eventually it'll happen, I think they probably are in a better position to be upgradable to it than they were even in the past, just because they've gone through this cycle a couple times. So yeah. I would imagine that they're hopefully a little bit better prepared on doing those upgrades, but you know, it could be proven wrong. I do agree with Mike though on the, once they come out with 4, that's going to be their focus on a lot of their newer stuff. What do you think, Wes? Do you think upgrades are going to be likely if they do release hardware 4?
Yeah, I think if you've bought FSD, you'll get upgraded to the new hardware. Like I can't see them not doing that. They did that with 2.5 to 3. You know, and I got upgraded on my car, even the one that I sold, that got upgraded too. So I don't see them doing that. I don't see them abandoning people like that.
Well, riddle me this, Wes. Let me twist that a little bit from a consumer point of view. Let's assume they want to do the upgrade. My concern would be they're not going to have the hardware to give it. The hardware is going to go into all the new cars that they can't build today. And unless they pull some back and keep it in reserve, there won't be hardware available for the old cars for the upgrade.
Yeah, and I can see that there's going to need to be more than one board design, you know, to accommodate not only new production, but, you know, either inventory or past production. And so I get that, you know, there's definitely going to be a hierarchy there of like, well, we have to serve production first and make sure there's good throughput in production. That's but just like rolling out anything new, it's going to come with issues. So my thought is that Tesla is in a much different position now because they're such a major player in the automotive industry that they're going to be able to get throughput of chips, and they'll be able to make boards because they're good at making boards now. You know, as opposed back then, it was much harder because they were such a niche, you know, very, very low quantities, low throughput, you know, and a lot of changes, which made it hard for them to work with.
Oh yeah,
board companies. But now, you know, much, much more fluid, much higher quantities, and they're always on the latest technology, so they like that. You know, these companies that they work with like that. They like, you know, you're ordering millions of chips. Great, we like that. You know, you're on the latest technology. Brilliant, we love that. You know, and if you need a board change or if you need another board, yeah, we can work with you. You know, they're much, much more lax in being able to do that. So I think Tesla's in a much different place than, you know, the previous new chip rollout.
Yeah, I mean, so we've had a couple viewer comments, you know, Michael Mooney, you know, made a comment saying, a lot of comments. If they have the compute, they could downscale resolution for a few years until older cars cars with older sensors are less common. That's certainly true. The problem is if you're expecting a certain resolution and you want full self-driving and your models are trained in a certain way, there is some risk there, but it is certainly something they could consider. Bruce Ma mentioned, you know, ask autopilot or AP1 owners about upgrades. So there's definitely a lot of, I've seen a lot of drama there on the forums and other places there are people that have been left behind, right? So, I mean, Tesla's not a perfect company. You know, there's no such thing as a perfect company. And they've certainly messed up in some cases, I would say messed up for certain users. Bruce, my opinion is you're right. They screwed up back then and they hopefully won't make that same mistake when they do the transition to 4. So, for example, in my opinion, I think they could do better with adjusting the camera placement. I don't think they will, because that would make upgrading much harder to do or almost impossible to do. Wes said, as long as it's good enough, then they think they can get away without changing it to improve the compatibility. I think they will keep those types of things where they are. And I think, again, hopefully they've learned their lesson that hardware 3 to 4 will be an upgrade that's doable, unlike the early Autopilot 1 folks, which, again, I feel bad. Wes, were you there during any of that, or was that before you when that first transition?
I was there during AP1 to AP2 transition.
Okay. So there's probably things you can't talk about with that, but I mean, the decisions around, you know, not supporting hardware upgrades for everybody or all models, were they just things that couldn't be done in certain cases?
Yeah, it's just things that couldn't be done because the cabling, you know, the wire harness, the throughput, the robustness, you'd have to replace, you know, there's so much. There was a time, in fact, one of my buddies, he got on his original SIG, I believe. He paid for the big upgrade to do parking sensors at that time. And that was like a crazy amount of work, you know, to do that, to get all those pucks, not only in the panels and in the, you know, in the fascia, but to be able to do all that cabling and then to have it all wired up was pretty phenomenal. But for AP, you know, a lot more, because the windshield has to change, the headliner has to change, you know, lots of the braking system and the steering system and lots of components were vastly different. So the changes were phenomenal by comparison to just, you know, doing parking sensors.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess if they were to do this upgrade, hopefully it's not nearly that involved. So it'd be,
no, it wouldn't be. It's just, it's the board, honestly.
Right. The cameras at the end of the cabling.
Yeah. It's the board should have less power needs. So it's not like, you know, for some reason it's going to stress the system more. It should be easier on the system overall. I don't see any reason why they couldn't upgrade it. That's not, you know, that's how I would design it if I was there.
I have to call out this comment. So Michael Lloyd made a comment. He said, I can't buy a Plaid spoiler for my long range refresh. What would give me confidence I could buy hardware, you know, 4 or whatever when it's available? First of all, Michael, I have to say I'm offended at your notion of putting a Plaid spoiler on a long range. I've had multiple people ask me if my badge was real on my car or if it was a long range with a badge. No, I'm just teasing. I mean, aftermarket spoilers are available, but I agree with you. It is a little silly that, you know, you can't get certain parts. And a lot of that is just due to supply chain constraints. I'm hoping that alleviates, you know, COVID is unfortunately not done. It's in its impact of, you know, global supply chains. But yeah, hopefully that stuff improves. But yeah, if you get into a bad accident, getting new parts is definitely tricky. It took me almost 2 months to get them to fix my A pillar, right? So, I mean, it's a simple part and they kept going, we don't have the part. So I'm still mad about it. Jones is laughing at me.
I mean, I've had to buy parts off eBay because that's the only place I can get parts in a timely manner.
Yeah, for sure.
It is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's rough all around, but hopefully, you know, hopefully we'll see. But I think Wes is spot on, though, that there might be some delay afterwards, but eventually it should be available, right? When Hardware 3 and Hardware 2.5 upgrades happened, you didn't get them right away. It took a while, but eventually you could get them, which I think is important. So moving on to our next topic, I'll get everybody's buy-in or input here. There's been another big rumor slash leak slash whatever, however you want to handle this. The Model 3 and the Model Y may be losing their stocks. Their steering wheels may be upgrading. Upgrading. I put in quotes for those non-video viewers. Yeah, what do you think on... Let's start with Mike. What do you think about this, Mike?
All right, I'll make it really clear. If they actually do this, by the time I get my Y, I'll cancel the order. I swear to God, I will cancel the order.
That's strong.
I am not a fan of the yoke, and I am even less of a fan of them mucking around with how I work with various controls on the car.
Sure. I will say there was, so before I bought my Plaid, before I put the order in, I was also hesitant. I'm like, oh, the yoke, there's no stocks. I don't know if I'm going to like this. The thing that kind of pushed me over to say go for it is there's a gentleman that I saw post online who basically took a Model 3 like drive sleeve thing, whatever it is behind the steering column. That's the word I couldn't think of for a second.
Drive sleeve.
Actually put stocks in and used an MCU and basically programmed it to where he had his own stock mod that worked perfectly with the Plaid having the yoke. And that was like, well, I know I could do that. I'm an engineer. I can do the hardware. I can do the software. When I saw that was available, that's why I said, well, if I hate it, I'll just change it. So, yeah. I mean, for three, you could always add your own stocks, Mike. You have the skills. You can do it.
I'm adding my own performance brakes. Why not add a stock too, right? Yeah. No, I mean, we'll see what they do. I have a feeling the general consumer population would not be a fan of it.
Sure.
I think they're struggling to deal with the whole iPad interface, and they're struggling to deal with, you know, touch this and touch that. I know my wife, who is a consumer, she's not an engineer. She has been very vocal about the lack of physical controls for certain things of the Model 3, like the wiper blades, the venting, you know, things that just drives her insane. She likes the car, but those little things just kind of grate on her. And I think removing the stocks would be the end of it. That just push her over the edge. Yeah. Adam's asking, how do our hosts feel about volume knobs? Dude, I'm analog. I like my analog knobs.
Yeah. So I will point out that, you know, the volume knob is still it's a wheel. It's still a wheel on the yoke. So they're still physical.
Although, you know, In the pre-show, I was talking about how we rented the Y for the weekend, and I was trying to show my wife how to use the knob sideways, you know, to move the mirror, and she was struggling with that. She goes, "Why can't I just have a blankety blank button?"
That's fair. So, Wes, what's your take on this? What do you think about removing the stocks? One, do you think it's likely to happen? And two, do you think it's a good idea?
I don't know if it's likely to happen, but my thought is that if in testing, Tesla is seeing that the usability and the function of the car is getting better, you know, for the engineers and the folks who are at Tesla, and if they like it better, then I do see that it'll change, because removing the stocks is going to save money. So there's, you know, it's going to save weight. That means less batteries to go further amount of distance. And I like all of that. And then also I like the idea that if you're removing the stocks, like, more than likely some amount of AI is also the reason for that, because you're relying less on these, you know, older kind of antiquated controls for cars and more on, you know, the future, which is software. And so I'm a proponent of that type of innovation, you know, because that's what I did for many years. So I have a bias there. Sure. And I do think that it, from my standpoint, I tend to not like buttons. I think the button on the Mach-E screen is ridiculous. And I've said it many times. I think it's just hilarious that there's a giant mechanical button on the middle of the iPad screen. But we try to move things forward, right? Like we try to innovate, we try to find better ways of doing things, lower cost, lower weight, more range, like all those things are good. And then the usability should go up. Like, and I get, you know, that people like things the way they were sometimes. But, you know, when I drove, we recently got back from a trip in Ireland and I rented a car that was stick and you drive on the other side of the road and you shift with your left hand. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was so retro for me. But my phone connected to Android Auto, like, and that worked pretty well most of the time. But at least I didn't have to futz with a bunch of buttons and try to, you know, do all that. I just had to pair it and away I went. And so that was great.
Sure.
So I'm kind of pro innovation on this side because I feel like usability should go up.
Have you used a Yoke yet, or have you done one of the driven one of the stockless Teslas?
You know, I haven't. I've only seen it in videos and once in person because my friend wasn't willing to let me drive his. I can be an aggressive driver. No, I'm kidding.
Well, yeah, if you come down to Austin, I'll let you drive mine. So
yeah,
you're in town.
Yeah. Well, if you've ever driven in my Model X, I have a Ludicrous Plus, like it's crazy fast. So, but I would think that I have driven a Yoke before, in various carts that I've driven.
Sure.
And then, simulation, you know, with a real F1 steering wheel when I went to Formula E, which was super cool. Sure. And I find them highly usable. Like, right. I would never want a round steering wheel in a car race.
I love my Yoke.
Like, that would terrify me.
It's amazing.
You know, like Yokes are the only way to go in a race, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm a former racing bicyclist. And like, I can't even imagine, you know, you only really want one hand placement in a bike race, at least, you know, for the type of racing that I did. You know, or else things are going to get too complex, you know,
sure.
You need that one placement. You need to feel comfortable behind the wheel. And I think you're going to be touching the wheel a lot less in the future.
For sure.
On that side, like I think the usability goes up and now my vision is better, you know, as a passenger of the car.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, anyway. It seems so. We have a lot of Yoke drivers in chat, you know, chiming in right now. Jones and YOLO and
I'm not sure. I'm not sure YOLO's my friend anymore.
I have to say, you know, I agree with Michael's comment. He said Michael Lloyd said important to note: don't conflate yokes and steering wheels with stock and stockless. They are two totally different decisions. I 100% agree with you, sir. I've had massive arguments with people on Reddit. One of my things I try to avoid is not to argue with people on the internet, and yet I sometimes my wife makes fun of me because I do it anyway. I love the Yoke driving my car. I think the Yoke is fantastic. I do not miss a wheel at all. What I will say though is the thing that bothers me the most. There's two issues people complain about: steering wheel the horn not being in the middle. Does not impact me at all. I don't care because one, I don't naturally have the instinct to honk my horn. I usually move out of the way to avoid something rather than signal. That's just how I drive. I grew up in Jersey near, you know, driving in New York City, like honking doesn't help. but what I'll say, what does drive me nuts is the lack of the stocks for turning. When you're in a turn signal or traffic circle, a roundabout, a rotary, whatever you want to call it, and you're in a turn and your Yoke is like whatever, and then you're like, oh, I need to signal to exit now. How do I do that? It's always in a different position and I'm always like, wait a minute. And then you've got to think like, oh, wait, reverse what I did and blah, blah, blah. And so a lot of times I don't get to signal as much as I used to leaving a traffic circle. The rest of the time, 99.999% of, you know, we'll go to Six Sigma the rest of the time I'm driving, I don't miss the socks at all. I think Don't need them. They're wonderful. Normal turning, turn signal, fine. In a traffic circle, it sucks. It's real hard to do. So I think it's questionable that they're maybe removing stocks for everybody, but, you know, we'll see. I agree with you, Wes, though. I think cost, weight, all those other things like would be justification of why they do it. And for most of the time, it won't impact folks. But I can you imagine like living in like London and driving without stocks? Like I can't. The number of traffic circles they have to go through on a daily basis. I have to do it here in Texas a bunch, but I don't know. Let's see. Jones Ones thinks it's a great idea. Two less parts to worry about. Okay, Jones. I mean, I get you, but so here's the thing. What I found in the arguments online is, you know how most drivers don't signal? I feel like the drivers that don't signal think it's a wonderful idea because they don't signal anyway. So why do they need to hit the stops?
Doesn't matter.
And then the drivers like myself that don't honk, we don't care about the middle honking thing and all the, and there's lots of people that are really aggressive in the honking. And what I've noticed is it seems to be the same people. So the people that don't signal are also the ones that care the most about the horn. And the ones that don't care about the horn, like myself, seem to be the most impacted by the signal.
You know, it's funny, Lewis. You know, I'm of a certain age that I remember cars having the big horn in the middle with a rim, you know, beep, beep, you know. Then I remember in the early 70s, someone got clever, and I think it might have been Lincoln or someone, but they put buttons on the side. There was no center anymore, and you had buttons. Oh, man, just all the hate and discontent from that. And they went back to a rim design a couple years after that. You know, the consumer wasn't having part of a button. So, you know, back in the 70s, they tried the button thing on the steering wheel, and it didn't fly. We'll see if we've gotten more sophisticated.
I don't see Elon bowing to public pressure. He is a strong-minded individual.
That's why I've got a Y on order and I've got a Lyric on order. I'll pick and choose when they show up.
Okay.
can I tell you a quick story?
Go ahead, Wes.
When AP was being developed, we decided to remove the ability for the light on the stock of the cruise control lever to turn on and off. I don't know if you guys remember this on Model S, but Elon hated that light. He hated it. He would say, it's like a laser beam shooting me in the eye. And so we just disabled that. The control team disabled that light so that it wouldn't go on and off as you were turning, you know, cruise on and off or activating it or enabling it to be activated. But I just find that funny that this has been the fruition of that battle that I think that he's been waging to kind of remove stocks, you know, and remove the steering wheel in general, eventually, I would think, you know, for robotaxi.
Sure. Yeah. Dave comments, I love the yoke, but I sure do miss the energy graph. Yeah. I think the energy graph is cool. I don't know. I don't know about why.
I like my data. I like my data.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you have an engineer driving. Yeah, my wife is more concerned about her XM radio interface than the energy graph. So.
Yeah, I don't know. It's contentious. We'll definitely see how things go. The other, I guess there's two sides of the stock argument, though. The other one is the drive selector. That I can't imagine people missing, right? Like, I don't miss the drive selector at all. You know, I'm in my garage, I turn on my car, I sit in it, it's like, hey, we're gonna go reverse now. It's like, great. You know, it does a pretty good job at figuring that out. But I don't think, I mean, the point being, there's definitely times where I have to manually say, no, we're going the other way on the touchscreen. But it's a quick swipe, it's pretty easy to do. So I don't think it's worse than a drive selector. So I think getting rid of that stock is okay, but I don't know. Well, do you imagine that being an issue, Mike, for you, like removing a drive selector?
Not really. I mean, I've driven cars without push buttons. I think the worst interface was the iDrive on the BMW. I never cared for that. Never cared for that.
So bad. Oh.
I can see Wes shaking, you know.
Oh my goodness.
There's so a visceral bad. Reaction there.
Yeah, it's horrible. Like, it's hard to even like comprehend how they came up with that.
Yeah, well, focus group, man. Focus group.
Yeah.
Designed by committee, as always. All right. So one of our next thing I want to like to bring up or talk about is there was drama recently around the Moody's credit rating for Tesla. Oh, now, on this show, we tend to not talk too much about stock and investment because it's a fairly contentious topic. I don't know why that stops us because we talk about all kinds of contentious things. But since Wes has such a lot of insights and expertise in this topic, we decided let's go for it. Let's bring it up. So Wes, can you give us a little bit of background on, you know, high level what's going on here, and then we can debate.
Moody's is this credit rating agency. They're kind of the top dog, you know. And so Tesla is basically rated very, very low currently, even though it's one of the top five companies in the world by market cap. It has some of the most amazing products that pretty much, you know, I would say that people want. I think I'm safe to say that.
Just a few.
And yet, for whatever reason, this credit rating agency doesn't think that Tesla is investment grade. They think it's much lower than that. And there's been a lot of back and forth and hand-wringing about this. And Tesla doesn't need this. Let's be perfectly honest. They don't need to be investment grade. But like all these other top, you know, 100 companies in the world are investment grade, you know, and rightly so. You know, it's like these are good companies. These are top of the world companies, you know, like why wouldn't you want to invest in them as, you know, if you have a large fund? So it's just really interesting that they've chosen to take this stance. You know, Tesla has risen so far, so fast, you know, they're obviously, as everybody knows, they're the biggest car company by market cap. You can take pretty much every other car company, add them all up, and they don't equal Tesla. And yet still not investment grade. So it's odd, because some of these other car companies are investment grade. So it's like, how is that even possible? And a couple folks online, Twitter, one in particular goes by Tesla Boomer Mama. Shout out to her. She's doing amazing work. She's a former Moody's analyst. And it's just amazing to see the kind of data that she's put together. It's so easy to read and consume. And has done a fabulous job of getting a response from Moody's, who's given her kind of I would agree with Dave, or, you know, like our own Dave T, and his response is pretty ridiculous, that they're looking for more of a qualitative reason, even though they're a ratings company, and that's quantitative by its very nature. So it's just odd that they're taking that stance. So it's going to happen eventually, you know. I mean, if Tesla becomes the largest company by market cap, you know, you would really wonder, like, do we need to see more qualitative data at that point? It's already ridiculous, but, it just kind of adds to the ridiculousness. As we start to see Q3 earnings come in, should be amazing, you know, and Q4 and Q1, they're just going to keep continuing to get more and more amazing, unless we see another force majeure. There's nothing stopping Tesla as a company from out innovating, you know, to put it bluntly, the rest of the world. They're just out innovating the world.
I have a few questions I would like to ask you about this, but first I think I feel obligated to say, that I personally do not have any financial connection to Tesla one way or the other with regard to investing or shorting. I stay away from them. Most of my investments are in index funds. I'm not a gambler type investor, which I would view investing in individual stocks usually is. I do have a few, but not Tesla. I would say it's safe to say you're probably on the investor side, pro Tesla, you know, as a good investment. Do you view... actually, before I ask that, let me ask you this. So I would say traditionally there's the traditional investors, or the folks that kind of look at historical and how companies were in the past, on average tend to be pretty skeptical of Tesla, right? There's all the tons of famous, the most shorted company, tons of people that say that it was overvalued, all this kind of stuff. Do you think Moody's investment rating, their credit rating that they're giving it, saying it's not investment class, I think part of it is a holdover of their viewing of things being like the old traditional way? You think they maybe just haven't woken up to the modern marketplace and how things are in the current?
Probably, or maybe, and who's to say for sure outside of them when they actually do come around and make the change? But like, you know, Tesla got into the S&P. you know, after four quarters of showing profit, you know, so that happened. This mm-hmm. this will happen too eventually, but it does seem pretty antiquated in what they're currently demonstrating. You know, they're showing to the world that they don't think Tesla is investment grade. Great. Why? Well, they say it's qualitative. All right. Well, that's not what rating agencies do. And when you look at the quantitative numbers, and this is what, you know, Alexandria has done really well, Tesla Boomer Mama. She's put together this great spreadsheet which shows how Tesla is basically just knocking it out of the park in all of the areas that Moody's cares about quantitatively. So it's odd. It's really odd. So I do see this changing fairly quickly, and it's not like they need to wake up or something. You know, I don't feel like it's that, but yeah, it does seem a bit more antiquated. It's like, wow, Tesla's, you know, going pretty quick. And maybe, you know, they're a flash in the pan, or maybe, you know, the stock really is overvalued, or da 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 da, you know, all of these interesting kind of Tesla bear things that I've heard over the years. But yeah, it's just my perspective is vastly different. And I think the comment that you made about stock and potentially gambling and all of that, you know, stocks in general is how people have built wealth, you know, in the history of our country. And I've been lucky enough to be able to do that too. And I'm not, you know, this, none of what I should say, my disclaimer, it's not financial advice, nothing I say. But, you know, I'm very close to the technology and I'm very confident, you know, that it's going to keep going up. So that's why I continue to invest. And that's why I've been able to retire. And sure. It's been a wild ride. It will continue to be a wild ride as Tesla continues to disrupt all of the major industries of innovation. So it's just going to continue to keep happening. And Moody's is just one step along the way. We've already crossed so many other hurdles, but Moody's just the current step.
I think you said the key right there, though, why Tesla isn't loved by a lot of the investment world. They are disruptors, and investment folks generally don't like disruption. That's not what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. They make money on volatility. So they, in some respects, they do like disruption because it creates volatility and they like that.
But yeah.
There's other things where they're going to lower their valuation if they see, you know, massive change occurring. So in a sense, I do agree with you on that standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any question that, and again, none of us are financial advisors. I don't think there's any debate on the fact that investing is a good way to get financial stability and to, retire and all those other types of things. Like, it's certainly a smart long-term plan. I think really the where the discrepancy is like, do you mostly pick one stock and ride on it, right? That's generally viewed as a gamble into some sense versus diversifying your portfolio in some aspect. Because, for example, like, you know, and just throwing out your random, you know, stats or whatever, but like, if Bill Gates hadn't sold his Microsoft fortune, he'd be worth more riding that gamble on Microsoft than Bezos and Musk combined right now, right? Like, stuff like that is mind blowing to think about, but like, he diversified, so he's not worth as much money as he could be. But on the flip side, he also mitigated his risk of maybe he, you know, something could have gone bad. Antitrust could have broken it up. You know, there's a million things that you don't know. So like, I think with Tesla, for example, one of my fears as far as an investment stock is like, what happens if Elon Musk gets hit by a, you know, let's say he gets hit by a GM Cruise vehicle. No, something bad happens outside of his control or anyone else's control. Do you think Tesla will stay in its dominant position for an extended period? Like, certainly Apple weathered that with losing Steve Jobs, unfortunately. And they seem to have held on for the most part. You know, they're not innovate. I would argue they're not innovating, in my opinion. They're not innovating as much as they were, but at the same time, they're still massive and have tons of money and sell lots of products because they're able to keep building off what they had. I worry that Tesla maybe couldn't do that as well without Elon. I feel like Elon is the person driving Tesla. So do you think that there's some justification in maybe it's a riskier, like it's not risky as long as things go well, but if something bad happens, right? Like such as Elon goes away, you know, maybe it becomes risky. Or do you think Tesla is so set up that it doesn't matter? Elon, no Elon, it's going to the moon.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Well, Elon is definitely a valuable contributor, but I don't, at this point, I think he's instilled into the company and in people like Drew, who, you know, I used to work with very closely, and JB as well. Like he's just instilled this relentless pursuit of innovation. And I really do feel like he's attracting the best talent to continue to do that. And that's going to continue. And I honestly, like, I don't see him going anywhere for quite some time. You know, I get bad things can happen, but I really do think that May is looking out for him. So I think that's a good thing. She's a wonderful person. So I do feel like Tesla will continue to go on. And do absolutely amazing things because the mission, you know, advent of sustainable energy and all the things that are being done right now, there's so much on the product roadmap that we probably haven't heard of yet. And even the things that are, you know, an AI day coming up, I really feel like that's going to take years for that to play out. Mm-hmm. You know, to be able to create ambulatory AI is going to be amazing. So
sure.
No, I honestly don't think there's a problem if Elon were to take a step back, because I do think the brains that are there currently, the vision is there, it's installed. The culture isn't there, it's installed, and that it's going to continue. And sure. I'm extremely bullish on the things that are happening still at Tesla. You know, even without my direct involvement, there's still people there. Like Ashok, who's doing such an amazing job at running all of the stuff that he's doing. It's just absolutely knocking it out of the park. So sure. You know, kudos to the whole team and the people that I used to work with that are there. Love it. Love everything they're doing. More power to them. And I continue to invest in what I think and what I know is the best company. And that's where I put it. And I put my money where my mouth is, and I appreciate everything that's happened in there. So yeah, that's a slightly long answer, but there you have it.
Sure. I mean, I think it is funny, the survivorship bias in the Tesla community around investing in the stock and even crypto, for example. Like I go to car shows here in Austin, and it's funny because I'm like, you know, Jones One, for example, in the chat said, my Tesla stock purchased him his Tesla, right? And there's a lot of that. When I do the Tesla meetups here in Austin, the vast majority of people I meet, they're like, oh yeah, I invested in Tesla, made a bunch of money, bought my Tesla with it. The other Plaid owners that I know, if you didn't know, I have a Plaid. No, the other Plaid owners that I know, they many of them bought it through Tesla investing or crypto. In fact, I'm the only one I know of that didn't. I made my money the old fashioned way by working really hard and, you know, being successful through those endeavors. But like, a vast majority of people do. And I kind of feel like some of it is survivorship bias because we don't hear from the people that didn't make money off of it. Now, granted, unless you were very unlucky, you probably made money off of Tesla stock, right? Like the stock did quite well. But anyway, so it's interesting. I do want to ask a question though, you know, speaking about the future of Tesla and, you know, how things are going. So what products that we maybe know about? So obviously let's not worry about future possible things, but like Cybertruck, Semi, you know, the droid or the Tesla bot, sorry, that's what they call it, the Tesla bot, whatever. What type of product are you most excited for, or do you think is the most essential for the company's continued success into the future? Is there one that you think is the most important, or do you kind of think they're all, you know? All
yeah, it's kind of, and there's, you know, several different answers I could give here. Maybe from like a company surviving type of thing, they're doing all the right things with building the machine that builds the machine because they need more factories, you know, even if these current factories ramp to 2 million a year, you know, to be able to advance sustainable transportation and energy, you know, you just need more faster. You need to be able to go as fast as you're just able to go. And they learn so much by building factories that they can only build them so fast. And that's the kind of the meat and potatoes of the company. And everything else is icing, honestly. but it's really, really good icing, you know. That's the thing that's so hard for some people to kind of wrap their heads around with Tesla, you know, because there's so much FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt with all the disruption that's happening. You know, lots of people are making money on that volatility and spreading that stuff. But at the end of the day, they just manufacture cars better than any other car manufacturer right now. And they can do it at a better scale in the factories that they've built. The factories that they've built make more cars per X amount of seconds than any other factory in the world. So you've just got this amazing ability to manufacture and build the machines that build the machines. So their new technology with gigapresses is just phenomenal. And you throw that, you throw software on top of that, and now you're able to make this car much more engaging and fun. You know, the funnest experience you're going to have in any product you'll ever buy is the idea. And that's just something that is going to keep on going into the future. And I'll be perfectly honest, I didn't see the AI bot coming. Like, that kind of floored me in many ways. But now it seems like, man, Elon's got quite a vision, you know, about, hey, I'm building this AI, it's going to drive a car. I wonder, you know, how hard would it be if we made an actual Android and installed this AI into the Android? Could then that Android potentially drive the car? It's like, yeah, it could, but it could also do other things. It could work in our factories. Whoa, like, that's cool. What else could it do? You know, it's that level of thinking that's taken them, you know, to the heights that they already are. So I feel like it's the bread and butter is, you know, the factories and their ability to manufacture, you know, that's unfounded brilliance so far. But then you also have this amazing product, the Cybertruck, excuse me, that I think the whole world is kind of waiting on pins and needles for. And then to be able to completely...
Next year, fingers crossed.
Yeah. To completely upend trucking is also, you know, an unbelievable thing that hopefully will happen in the future. But they're creating these batteries that should hopefully bring about the ability to release these vehicles, you know, and it's the batteries that are really kind of providing the brilliance behind all of this. So it's the manufacturing and also these batteries that are kind of their bread and butter.
Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you. I feel like the battery technology is a huge important factor in them delivering so many things. And then also the manufacturing. Like, I'm a huge manufacturing nerd, having worked in it, and I feel like that is really the innovation. We have a few interesting, you know, comments. You know, Michael Lloyd said, you know, classic business model would delay release of innovation to maximize return on each innovation. Tesla seems to think innovation speed is the real value. So that's where I get nervous about the whole Elon thing, is I agree with you, and I feel like without him, Tesla kind of becomes more of a traditional company. Tech company still an Apple or a Google, but they maybe don't innovate as fast, where you're going to start having, you know, startups and other types of companies being where your innovation is. Michael Mooney says, take out Uber and Instacart, the robot shops for you and brings the items home and puts them away for you. It's an interesting take, Michael. And I, you know, it's funny, is there are other companies working in that space though. So is it necessarily Tesla's robot that wins? Maybe, maybe not. I have a former colleague that is he's a CTO of a company that's doing the, you know, self-picking and shopping and all that kind of stuff for big factories like Walmart and, you know, those types of companies. And so it's a big space. But I know, Wes, do you think Tesla's going to move in? Michael's bringing up virtual power plants. Do you think virtual power plants are a big play?
That'll be a game changer. That'll be a huge game changer.
It's so huge. I totally agree. It's that type of thing is just absolutely, once that starts to really grow and get bigger and we start to see it managing terawatt, talk about turning the entire energy market on its head like that. It's hard to even comprehend how big that'll be, basically due to the standpoint that's, you know, nobody's ever attempted anything like this before. So I'm very excited about the future of that. It's fun to watch that play out.
Sure. No, that's great. So, I mean, I just have to say, I greatly appreciate you being here and being on the show. Hopefully,
thank you so much for having me.
You know, our viewers learned a lot. I learned a lot. do you have any final thoughts or words or things you want to say on Tesla? I mean, buy the stock.
I would totally plug the investor section of TMC. I think what's happening there, the type of people that participate there are absolutely amazing people. Such brilliant thought goes into it. There's a lot of great conversation that happens. The moderators are fabulous. They do such a good job at keeping people focused and really relevant to what's happening. There's so much disruption that's happening. So there's so much fear, uncertainty, and doubt wrapped around Tesla. And it's easily dispelled once you have some kind of basic fundamental knowledge of what's happening. And that's a place to get it. You don't have to invest, but you can get that type of information there. And it's just been wonderful. It's kind of changed my life, you know, as a former engineer, product manager, and now an investor. Like, it's made a huge difference in my life and has been a great value. And I really appreciate that exists on the forum.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure our producers appreciate the Tesla Motors Club forum plug. Again, thank you so much for being here, and it was great having you.
Great.
I need to thank our producers and everyone behind the scenes that helps make this happen. Danny, Doug, Adam, James, Josh. Hopefully I'm not forgetting anybody. Mike, as always, it's been a blast. So that's it for episode 20. Thank you all for listening. And don't forget, like, subscribe, all that stuff. Hit the bell.
Hit the bell.
Social media.
Ring the bell.
Become a supporting member on the Tesla Motors Club forums. I'm getting it out there. I apologize. It's been a day. Nice. My brain is a swirling with all the things I learned from Wes. All right. We'll see you guys next time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.